Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and boy, do we have a treat for you today.
That's right. We're chatting with Carl Zimmer about his new book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity.
This is a fantastic book. I was trying to finish it before we talked to him today, and I was up till 2 a.m. last night getting to the very last page, but it was worth it. It is a great book. I really highly recommend it. It's a brick that's just full of weird, interesting delights and insights about how our views of heredity have changed over the years, all of the good and all of the evil that that knowledge has been used for, and also where it's going in the future.
Yeah. It's a fascinating book. I also I got to see him in conversation with Maria Konnikova at World Science Festival this year, in which he talked about the themes in the book as well. So it was a real delight to have him here on the show. And if you want to check out She Has Her Mother's Laugh, it is available in hardback, digital, and as an audiobook. So we hope you enjoy our interview with him, but certainly go check out his book as well for just an in-depth, riveting journey through heredity.
Now, wait a minute. We should say who he is. I don't think we've done that. If you're not familiar with Carl Zimmer, Carl Zimmer is a prolific, excellent science writer. He writes for the New York Times. I think I've also seen his articles in The Atlantic and National Geographic, all over the place. He's written a lot about parasites, and some of the most interesting stuff in biology is Carl's territory. And I really had a good time talking to him today.
Yeah, some of his past books include Parasite Rex, Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, and Microcosm.
So without further ado, here's our conversation with Carl Zimmer.
So Carl, what led you to write a book about heredity?
I guess in a way I've been thinking about heredity for forever, really. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, I would think back on my ancestors that my parents told me about, and you know, I'd wonder like, oh wow, if Roger Goodspeed had not sailed from England to Massachusetts in the 1630s, would I ever exist? You know, those sorts of things. And then when I became a father, I've got two teenage girls now, and you know, that immediately brought to bear just how urgent and mysterious heredity can be, because now there are these two people walking around who have inherited a lot of my genes, and you know, what is it that I'm giving them? You know, that suddenly becomes a very pressing issue. And I guess what really then kind of crystallized it all for me was that in the past few years, I've been doing a lot of reporting from the New York Times and elsewhere about the real revolution happening in biology, allowing scientists to sequence DNA, to rewrite DNA, and to also look at other kinds of biology that might help create this thing that we call heredity. And so it all kind of came together, and I realized that this would be something that I really wanted to spend a couple years really exploring deeply.
So you mentioned the idea of the sort of personal curiosity about our ancestors, and you talk in the book about how we often do family genealogies to sort of learn something about ourselves, as if the seeds of who we are somehow present in our really distant ancestors. But how many generations back do you have to go before those relationships with our ancestors really don't matter all that much in terms of genetic closeness?
You know, you don't have to go back that far, and that just has to do with how parents pass down their DNA to their kids. You know, we each have two copies of each gene for the most part, but, you know, parents only pass down one copy of a given gene to each child. And so if you repeat that process generation after generation, there's a sort of a kind of a stochastic kind of random process that will basically lead to, you know, some descendants not having any DNA at all from a particular ancestor. There's only so much room in your genome, and you can't pack in all the DNA from all your ancestors, basically. And so geneticists have done some back-of-the-envelope calculations. And if you go back, let's say, 10 generations, that would be like your ancestors in the 1600s, maybe only about half of them have a genetic link to you. The rest, they're still your ancestors, but you cannot point to any piece of DNA in your genome and say, well, I got that from this particular person, you know? So, so I think that actually like really shows how we have to, think bigger when it comes to heredity. It's not just some particular bit of DNA that gives heredity its meaning.
Well, on the other side of that coin, could you talk a little bit about what the Yale mathematician Joseph Chang discovered about human ancestry? It seems sort of like the flip side of what you're just talking about.
Yeah, I mean, so much about heredity is counterintuitive and almost, you know, seems to contradict itself. And that's, in a way, what makes it so fascinating. So I just told you about how if you go back a certain number of generations, you're going to encounter ancestors from whom you've inherited no DNA at all. But there's an interesting feature of human ancestry, which is that, everybody today, shares a common ancestor with some people who lived about 5,000 years ago, roughly speaking. In other words, you can figure this out as Joseph Chang did, just by looking at genealogy as a mathematical problem. Just think of our genealogy as a kind of a branching network. The thing is though that if you think about your family tree, and you think, well, there's me, and then you branch off to your parents, and then they branch off to their parents, and so on and so forth. If you just keep branching in that simple way, you're going to end up, a few thousand years back with more ancestors than there are people who have ever lived. We're talking trillions of people, and that's absurd. So that's actually not a realistic model of your ancestry. The fact is that your parents are cousins. Now, either in some cases, first cousins get married, but in other cases, they're very distant cousins. What that means is that your parents share a common ancestor somewhere in the past. It could be hundreds of thousands of years ago, but it doesn't matter. They have an ancestor. So what that does is it folds the family tree back in on itself. And what Joseph Chang realized was that actually does something very interesting to human ancestry. What it means is that you do not have to go back very far to find somebody who is the common ancestor of literally everyone on Earth. It's just in the past few thousand years that you could find people like that. Now, of course, those common ancestors, for each of us, that's one person or a few people out of thousands upon thousands of ancestors, but it's something that ties us all together. And the irony is that, people are really, really love to connect themselves to someone famous, did you know that I am descended from William the Conqueror? And the fact is that probably everybody of European descent is a descendant of William the Conqueror. Probably everybody of European descent is a descendant of Charlemagne. It's possible that everybody on Earth is a descendant of, Cleopatra. That's just the nature of human genealogy, is that we're all descended from kings. That doesn't make anybody special.
Well, as long as we're gazing backwards in time here, can you tell us how ancient thinkers contemplated heredity?
The weird thing is that they really didn't. they didn't think about heredity in the way that we do. If you go back and you look at what Hippocrates would say or Aristotle would say, this whole model of how we inherit something, microscopic and biological that determines how we ended up the way we are just would not compute for them. And so, someone like Aristotle would say the reason that one generation looks like the previous one is just because it's the same chemistry. Of course you're going to be the same because you know, it's the same set of processes that produced a person, that produced you. So what's the big deal? And, you know, the word heredity, you know, it's a very old word, but it only referred to basically inheriting stuff, you know, and I'm not talking about genes. I'm talking about houses, you know, farmland, things like that. You know, so in the Roman Empire, there are lots of rules about, you know, who got to be an heir. And that's what the word meant at that point. And it's really fascinating. Like, you have to wait a long time before you start to even see the first glimmers of how we think about heredity today. My favorite example is in the around 1580, Montaigne, this famous essayist, he writes an essay about his father. Because Montaigne now is starting to get older and he's developing kidney stones. And it occurs to him that his father had kidney stones at around the same age. And he basically writes this essay saying, well, what is up with that? Did I get these kidney stones from my father? And, like, if so, how? Because, you know, when I was born, my father was young and he didn't have kidney stones. So what exactly went from him to me? And you want to just, you know, shout at the page, like, it's genes. But, you know, he can't hear you. You know, like, his question went fundamentally unanswered for centuries. It's really neat to look back and see how, you know, the way we think is not how everyone always thought. You know, the way we think about heredity is a product of really the modern age.
So did the selective breeding of animals and plants inform classical and medieval thinkers at all about the possible nature of heredity? Because it kind of seems like people such as Aristotle or Albertus Magnus would have looked at how we bred flowers, crops, and farm animals more, or at least in addition to the influence of geography or experience.
You would think so. I would have thought so. But I think that's because we are in the 21st century and we look back and say, well, everyone must have thought the way we did. But there are actually, you know, whole books written, you know, by Roman writers about farming, for example. And you can search them. I have sat down and looked through these books for anything resembling what you're talking about. And it's just not there. They do not talk about, oh, well, there is some, you know, quality in this particular variety of olives that, you know, if you breed it, it will pass it down to future generations of olive trees. That it isn't there. Instead, they'll say, like, well, make sure that, you know, you're growing it on good soil. Make sure your farm gets a good supply of rain. It's all about the environment. Huh. And it isn't really until, I would argue, it's not really until the 1700s that you start to see these farmers, these livestock breeders really take interest in this. And part of it is that these European countries are all looking for ways to use science to make their countries wealthier. And, you know, they're thinking, well, if we can produce new varieties of animals and plants, then we will enrich ourselves. And there's this one breeder named Robert Bakewell who produces an entirely new breed of sheep just by starting to think about heredity, to think about which individuals, those sheep, is he going to mate together? Is he going to just only mate within his flock? Is he going to go pick out other ones from other flocks to mate? And lo and behold, he produces this very successful new breed. And, you know, people like Charles Darwin look at that and say, what just happened? How did they do that? And in Germany and in Central Europe, there's a big push to do the same thing with sheep, to do that with crops as well, and to try to understand what are these rules. And one of those people who's trying to understand those rules is none other than Gregor Mendel. So his breeding experiments, you know, the foundation of genetics comes out of this new push to try to use heredity to enrich nations.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to jump right back into the interview.
And we're back.
So at what point does the modern idea of heredity really emerge?
Well, I'd say in the late 1800s, people start to talk about heredity as a scientific question. And Charles Darwin is really important in all of this because, you know, he comes up with this theory of evolution and it depends on heredity. In other words, the only way for natural selection to work is so if parents can pass down traits to their offspring that give them some advantage in surviving and reproducing. And so it's very obvious to Darwin that, you know, that heredity is this huge glaring question in the middle of his theory. And he works really hard to try to find out for himself how heredity works. And he's very aware of a lot of the research that's going on at the time, looking to the discovery of cells and the discovery that there are little things inside of cells, but no one's quite sure what they are. And so he develops a theory that there are particles in the cells throughout our body, that they somehow stream into the eggs and sperm and then become something like the way we think of genes. That doesn't pan out. You know, his cousin, Francis Galton, tries to test it by injecting blood from, black rabbits into white rabbits, or, you know, different colored rabbits, and seeing if that changes the color of their offspring. Doesn't happen. So it's not really until after Darwin is dead that scientists start to really understand chromosomes and then rediscover Mendel, and it all clicks together, and the science that they call genetics is born in 1900. It's really, you can see how exciting it is for the scientists at the time. William Bateson, who coined the term genetics, he writes at the time that the science of heredity has been revolutionized. You know, that finally they feel like they can understand heredity in its fundamental basis.
So how do we go from this point of just excitement and discovery and just fall so steeply into eugenics and then ultimately the horrors of the Third Reich?
Well, if you look back, the roots of eugenics go back pretty far. On the one hand, sort of our modern conception of race starts to develop as early as really the 1500s or the 1400s even, where in Spain, Jews are being considered a separate race of people, and noble families have to draw out genealogies to prove that they don't have any Jews in their ancestry. Otherwise, they won't be able to get that good job in government or so on. And so that starts to develop this idea that groups of people are fundamentally different in some way that is carried on from one generation to the next. Then in the 1800s, you start to see a real concern about poverty and crime, and a lot of people start to make claims that these are being carried down in certain families. You know, there are these bad families, and why is it that one generation is just as bad as the previous one? And, you know, people talk about some sort of hereditary curse that they must have, and how do we keep that curse from being propagated? And so then when genetics gets discovered, a lot of actual geneticists themselves and others say, well, aha, like here's the basis for what we've been talking about for decades now. The word eugenics had actually been coined in 1880s by Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin. And he just thought, well, you know, if intelligence is inherited, then why don't we just essentially breed people the way we breed sheep? So you just pick out the individuals who seem to have, you know, the most genius, he would call it, and then encourage them to have lots of kids. And he had these dreams that this would produce what he called a galaxy of genius in the future. But by the time that eugenics arrives in the United States and genetics emerges, it takes on a much darker cast because people say, well, what we really need to focus on is these people who have who we believe have genes that we don't like, and we want to prevent them from reproducing, because that's going to drag down our country. And so what are we going to do to keep them from reproducing? And that leads to sterilization and much worse.
So in reading your chapter about Henry Goddard and the origins of the American eugenics movement, I'm struck that this is a potential example of the dangers of bad research. Like, you draw a really disturbing picture of how sloppy or fraudulent work that became the basis of Henry Goddard's published writings on heredity can be viewed in some ways as contributing directly to real-world consequences like the horrors of forced sterilization in the United States or mass murder in Europe. Do you ever think, when you see bad science or pseudoscience being publicized today, that it could ever lead to such nightmares that even its authors might not have imagined?
I think that we can't rule out those kinds of possibilities. I mean, it might be very, very unlikely, but I mean, if you look at history, you can see how bad science combined with existing prejudices led to really horrific outcomes. And it wasn't that the science was somehow appropriated by pseudoscientists or something. Eugenics was embraced by most of the leading biologists of the time. There were different forms of eugenics, you know, so some people were very much sort of concerned, were quite racist and, you know, were concerned about, the white quote unquote race being, you know, polluted by other races. But then there were progressives who thought that this was going to be part of their grand plan for making society a better, fairer place. And I think it's really important to look at these episodes in history to see how things go bad. I think it's arrogant for any of us to say, well, things like this could never happen again. You know, somehow we're vaccinated from these sorts of things. But we can draw lessons from the past, and we can see how humble we need to be in the face of complexity in our own biology. You know, I think we're in another revolution the way we were 100 years ago. You know, 100 years ago, genetics itself was profoundly new. The gene was a new thing. Now we're at the point where we're looking at genomes. In other words, all the genes in our cells, and we can see them down to the atomic detail. But there's still a vast amount we do not understand about it. And, we cannot let that be an opportunity to, cart out our old biases and prejudices and say, oh, you see, now science backs up what I was saying all along about those other people. We cannot let that happen again.
I think that's a really good point. And I also think you could even look at it as there's a flip side to it where modern discoveries of genomics really complicate or in some senses undermine what many people have traditionally understood as the concept of race within humans, right?
Yeah, so the scientific concept of race developed in the 1700s, and it was really very much spurred on by what Europe was doing at the time. So Europe was in the midst of building up huge colonies, and enslaving many, many people. There was a need for sort of legal and moral justifications for doing this. And a lot of it was based on these concepts of race. So that, for example, you know, Africans were claimed to be a completely separate race that, you know, had inherent inferiority to the white race. And so therefore, slavery is okay. And you can just see this again and again in lots of writing at the time. Now, even in the early 1900s, there were indications that that genetics was not aligning with these old ideas about race. They just weren't fitting neatly. It was becoming harder and harder to sort of draw any particularly bright line between groups of people. I mean, obviously people are different. There are lots of differences in people in terms of skin color and height and shapes of faces and culture and all the rest of it. But the genes were not supporting these old ideas about race. And by the mid-1900s, a lot of anthropologists and geneticists were saying, you know, the word race is so burdened with so much that's terrible and immoral and has so little connection with the way we're starting to understand populations. Let's just abandon it. That really didn't happen, but nevertheless, like now we can look at whole genomes. The whole thing with race now is it's a bit one. The way one geneticist put it to me is like, well, you know, like talking for us, like talking about race is like the way Greeks talked about the four elements, air, fire, water, earth. Like, you know, Aristotle could explain all sorts of things that way, and they seemed good to him. But you know, we know that things are much more complex than the four elements. And if you forced physicists to go back to the four elements, they'd be very unhappy. So geneticists are saying, like, please don't make us go back to, you know, the genetic equivalent of the four elements. You know, they're very interested in ancestry and how populations mix together, how they become isolated and all the rest of it. But these old ideas about race and all the connotations of race, they don't map onto it at all. So they just don't want to use it.
Now, of course, in addition to just the passing on of genetic information, we also have epigenetics, and even as you explore the effects of the microbiome, can you talk about how these have changed our definition of heredity?
So in the 1800s, you know, heredity becomes a scientific question. You know, what is it that makes one generation connected to the past? Why is it that generations resemble their forerunners? What are these connections? And genetics provided a huge part of that answer, which is that, well, genes get copied and then transmitted through eggs and sperm. And so that was a huge revolution in our understanding. But that doesn't mean that that is all that heredity can be. I mean, there's still at least the logical possibility that there are other ways that each generation can be connected to the previous ones. And so in my book, I talk about different forms of heredity that scientists are exploring. One very exciting possibility is what you refer to as epigenetics. And epigenetics is kind of a broad term, but roughly speaking, what it refers to is the molecules inside our cells that control our genes, that allow some genes to be switched on and to produce proteins and others that are kept silent. It's very clear that this is incredibly important to our existence. You know, it's what makes your skin cells be skin cells and your, you know, brain cells be brain cells. Like, they are using different genes in the same genome. And when these cells divide, a skin cell does not normally instantly become a neuron or, you know, you don't grow a tooth on your back of your hand. And that has to do with epigenetics. And so what does this have to do with heredity? Well, you know, when those cells divide, they are basically inheriting the genes and the epigenetics of their mother cell. But, you know, the possibility arises, well, what if you pass those down to the next generation altogether, you know, through eggs and sperm? And there's some evidence that can happen. And what makes it especially exciting is that, you know, through our lives, experiences can change the epigenetic makeup of our cells. You know, so if you get sick, if you smoke, if you experience stress, those all seem to have an influence. And so the open question is, well, how much can those experiences we have in our lives then influence future generations? I think that the jury is still very much out when it comes to people. But in other species, especially plants, there's lots of evidence that really is something that happens. You know, a plant goes through a drought And generations later, there's still an epigenetic mark on its descendants. So, yeah, so epigenetics is a really exciting area.
So you just alluded to some of the controversy about epigenetics, and I guess there are other forms of ideas of non-genetic inheritance, but epigenetics in some ways still remains controversial, especially in humans, like you're talking about. If you're comfortable speculating, and if you had to guess, how would you imagine our picture of non-genetic inheritance might change over the next 50 years or so? What's your sense?
You know, I think that it is actually possible that we'll just find that human epigenetics is just not really that important. I mean, I think there's reason to be kind of pessimistic that, you know, there are these very tantalizing studies, but they're small and they could just be the result of noise and so on. And yet, you know, we really want epigenetics to be real. I mean, epigenetics has totally taken hold of the popular consciousness. And, you know, I was astonished to learn not long ago that you can take classes in epigenetic yoga, which, not kidding, you can Google it. And the thinking is, the claim is that, you know, that by doing this yoga, you change the epigenetic profile of your cells. And, you know, there are psychiatrists who will offer you epigenetic analysis to basically undo the trauma that you inherited from past generations. It really speaks to us in a very profound way, but I actually don't think the science is going to really hold up very well because it looks like our biology just doesn't really allow that to make much of a difference. But, you know, the flip side is that culture is actually, I would argue, an incredibly important form of heredity, especially for our species. We pass down not just our genes to the next generation, but all of our knowledge and beliefs and customs and so on. And those get propelled down through the generations in a very hereditary way. And that's actually very different from other species. In the book, I talk about how you could argue that civilization itself is the product of our very special form of cultural inheritance.
So in talking about non-genetic inheritance, you've got potentially epigenetics, though the jury's out on that. You've got culture, but we should talk a little bit about microbiology. Can you tell the story of how you found out that your belly button contained bacteria only known to exist in the Mariana Trench?
Absolutely, yeah. So I've been incredibly fascinated by the microbiome, you know, all the bacteria that live on us and in us for quite some time. And I have been doing some reporting on it as scientists have found new ways to explore our microbiome. And it used to be that you just have to scrape, a little bit of skin or take a stool sample and take it into a lab and try to grow bacteria. And the fact is that very few of the bacteria that live on us or in us enjoy being in a petri dish on their own. It makes them miserable and they don't grow. So we had a very impoverished view of this inner world until scientists were able to just say, okay, we're going to go into this sample and just grab out all the DNA and we're going to sequence all the DNA. And from that, we're going to figure out what is in there. And that totally revolutionized study of the microbiome because now you didn't have to grow these critters. You could just fish out their DNA and look at that. So it turns out we have hundreds, maybe thousands of species in our guts and on our skin and so on. And so, one day at a meeting, I was walking past a scientist who was holding out a Q-tip and he said, I'm doing a study on people's belly buttons. Would you mind giving me some of your belly button lint, and I want to see what's in there. You know, and for someone like me, you don't have to ask me twice. I'm like, give me that Q-tip. So, you know, I go off into the bathroom and I, you know, fiddle around and dunk it in a little tube that they gave me and handed it back. And then they went off and they looked at all the DNA that was on that Q-tip. And, you know, a lot of it was my own skin cells, but then a whole lot of it was not. And actually, they identified 53 species, as I recall, of bacteria just in my belly button. And it was amazing to look at the information about each of those species. And so one of them is only known from a sample at the bottom of the ocean, the Mariana Trench. And there's another one that I have that's only been found in soil in Japan. I've never been to Japan. So, but, you know, this was entirely unsurprising to this scientist because, he was looking at lots of people and was finding people with, you know, over 100 species just in their belly button alone and from all sorts of different places. So what does this have to do with heredity? Well, you know, I did not inherit that Mariana Trench bacteria from my parents. It's just, you know, we have all of this, these bacteria in the environment, and some of them have become very well adapted to living on our bodies, and we just pick them up through our life. But it does seem that the microbiome, that there is some heredity to it. The best examples come from certain animals that pass down bacteria to their offspring. And these bacteria can only live inside these animals. And without those bacteria, these animals die. So cockroaches are actually a great example of this. So, you know, one reason that cockroaches are so successful is because they harbor one species of bacteria in a special little organ where it breaks down some of their food and gives them nutrients. And these bacteria never live outside of cockroaches. And actually, they're sitting inside of cockroach cells. And then in the female cockroaches, those cells crawl over to an egg and rip open, and then the bacteria infect the eggs so that cockroaches are born completely infected with these bacteria. That's heredity. I mean, these bacteria are being passed down for millions of years from parents to offspring. So the question now is, well, is that true for humans? Maybe not, you know, in that particular way, but, you know, it is possible that there are a lot of species that are very much adapted to us. You know, maybe mothers are passing down certain kinds of bacteria in the birth canal or during breastfeeding. And maybe the most dramatic example of all is that in all of our cells, we generate fuel with these little blobs called mitochondria, which have their own DNA in them. And the reason they have their own DNA is because they started out as bacteria. And about 2 billion years ago in our single-celled ancestors, those bacteria infected our ancestors and then took up permanent residence in there, and we cannot live without them today. So microbes can have a very powerful part in heredity.
Do you think our expanding consciousness about the full scope of heredity from like cross-generation endosymbionts or even to chimerism should force us to re-examine our ideas about what it means to be an individual animal, and what the biological and categorical boundaries of the self really are?
Absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, heredity does not actually follow a lot of the simple rules that we assume it does. And it does bring into question what it means to be an individual, because, you know, we think of we started out with some original genome in a fertilized egg. So we inherited half of that genome from each of our parents. It came together in this new combination, and that's us. But, you know, that is not actually us, and in lots of different ways. So in one way, I mean, if you actually follow the cells that divide in an embryo, those cells can mutate and then mutate again and mutate again. So that if you were to look at, say, any two neurons in your brain, they would be different from each other because they've acquired different mutations as we developed. So there is no one genome in our body because we are what scientists call us our mosaics. But then that's not the end of it. So, you know, we think of heredity as going down through the generations, but heredity can also come back up in reverse. And so one example of this is when women become pregnant, cells from their fetus will circulate around in their blood. You can actually draw blood from a pregnant woman and sequence the genome of the fetus. That is done on a regular basis now. After pregnancy, those fetal cells may go away because the mother's immune system is clearing them out. But surprisingly often, those cells can establish themselves in a mother's liver, her thyroid gland, even her brain. And scientists refer to such people as chimeras. It's after the beast of Greek mythology. And you can get chimeras also from twins in the womb who are sharing DNA, sharing cells. And so you can literally have, one of the first discoveries of this was a woman who gave blood in the 1950s and totally baffled the blood bank because she was giving two types of blood at the same time. And they said, this is not possible. There must be some contamination somewhere. But it turned out that her blood was made up from two individuals, herself and a twin who had died when he was in infancy. And this is not something that's rare. Chimerism is probably quite common among humans. And it really challenges these ideas that we tell ourselves about heredity and individuality.
One of the weirdest and most interesting types of heredity you discuss in the book is it's 8 or so lines of contagious cancer found in nature so far. Can you talk a little bit about contagious cancer? And does it make sense to think of this cancer as an independent animal or organism of its own type, or as sort of an infection from an original animal's genome?
Yeah, this is where heredity gets really weird because when cancer arises in our bodies, it's another one of these cases of mosaicism. In other words, these cancer cells are gaining mutations that the rest of the body doesn't have, and those mutations allow them to reproduce quickly and to be very aggressive and destructive. Now, cancer usually either is wiped out by the body or is lethal. In either case, you don't have cancer surviving beyond the life of its host. We think of that as being weird. But it turns out that, in fact, cancer can endure. And this was really first discovered in a case with dogs where dogs would be developing these tumors, and it was very odd that the cancer seemed to spread like an infectious disease. And so people were scratching their head over this, and then they realized that actually what had happened was that the cancer cells themselves were spreading from one dog to another to another, and so that the cancer cells were not in fact related to the dogs that they were in. And if you look at the DNA of this cancer, it goes back to some dog that lived maybe 10,000 years ago. And it has just been spreading from dog to dog ever since. And it's been mutating along the way. And so it's this thing that, it's what do you call it? I mean, I don't know what we could call it. But, some have argued that it should be just given its own species name because it's this lineage of animal cells that has its own genome and has its own way of getting around in the world. It's doing just fine. So surely it deserves a name. And then it turns out that in a few other cases, scientists have found it in other species. So Tasmanian devils in Tasmania, they get a facial tumor because they bite each other when they're fighting, and they spread this cancer to each other. And this cancer has actually arisen a couple times in Tasmania just in recent decades. So it isn't something that only happened once a long time ago. And what's most mind-blowing is that some scientists stumbled across this yet again just in the past few years in clams, in shellfish, and have discovered that there's contagious cancer in the ocean. So you're swimming, as you're swimming in the ocean, you're swimming around cancer cells that are moving from host to host.
An infectious cancer as its own type of organism, what kingdom of life would that be? Would it be an animal?
Yes, it would be an animal simply because it's descended from animals. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say they would have to be given, you know, a place in the animal kingdom. But, and, you know, maybe you should just still call it like a species of, you know, maybe the dog cancer should be a species of dog, maybe, you know.
Wild.
Canis cancer or something. I don't know. I don't know. you know, it's, and, you know, when you talk about sort of what makes up an animal, you know, like, what makes up us, you know, like, we think of cancer cells as being part of ourselves. They originate from our own cells, but, imagine if your body was actually made up of your own cells and then cells that came from someone 10,000 years ago, that would be weird.
Yeah. All right, time for a quick break, then we will be right back for more of our conversation with Carl Zimmer.
All right, we're back. Now, we can't talk about the future of heredity without touching on CRISPR. How is this technology affecting the future of human heredity?
Well, you know, we're going to have to wait and see exactly what happens, but certainly the potential is profound. CRISPR is just a few years old, and it's this technology essentially to zero in on any particular bit of DNA, cut it out, and if you want, insert a different little stretch of DNA in there. So this raises the possibility of being able to cure hereditary diseases by rewriting the DNA in cells, you know, to repair a faulty gene. But what some scientists have been already exploring is, well, what if you take human embryonic cells? What if you take, you know, human embryos that are just a tiny little cluster of just, you know, 7 or 8 cells, and you use CRISPR to rewrite their DNA? Let's say you fix a hereditary disease in just this handful of just these few cells. Well, that if that person were to develop from those cells, they would have CRISPR-altered genes throughout their whole body. And if they were to have children, they would pass on those CRISPR-altered genes as well. And so, you know, that these experiments have already begun on these tiny little human embryos. And so really, you know, what needs to happen now is for us to have a kind of global conversation about whether we want to use this or not, whether it's safe, whether it's ethical, how do we feel about who should have access to this? Do we have the right to alter future generations? And, you know, maybe we'll feel comfortable with, say, you know, eradicating Huntington's disease. But what if somebody says, well, yeah, but I'm using IVF and I want to just give my kids this mutation that we know reduces your odds of getting Alzheimer's. Could I do that as well? And then, you know, what if you add on other things? What if you add on things that are not, don't have to do with immediately treating some hereditary disorder, but, you know, change a trait, change hair color, change height, change all these things. Are people going to be comfortable with that? And this all, you know, the science fiction writers have had a monopoly on this conversation until now, but I think that everybody else needs to be talking about it too.
Now, as far as CRISPR-altered genes go, given like a near-future scenario, would they be detectable? Would somebody be able to say, to look at an individual's genome and say, oh, well, you've had, there's gene-altering evidence here? Or would a future civilization be able to look back at our genetic information and say, oh, well, look here, in this particular family line, we see evidence of CRISPR alteration?
That's an interesting question. I think that it would be possible if the people doing the CRISPR changing left behind a mark, of what they were doing, you know, a watermark, think of it that way, you know, some distinctive sequence of non-coding DNA nearby that basically says, hello, you know, this CRISPR alteration was brought to you courtesy of such and such hospital, you know. you could totally encode a message in DNA. People have encoded entire books in DNA now. So you could do that. But if somebody decided not to leave a watermark, then no, actually, I think it might be very difficult to say, oh, well, this person descends from a CRISPRed ancestor.
Knowing tech companies, I know we'd end up with like 30-page EULA agreements in there.
Sure, absolutely. But, you know, the problem is that, you know, that over the generations, they would get that agreement would mutate and, you know, the legal language would change into things that the lawyers didn't have in mind.
So given the great power that that CRISPR has to allow us to alter our genes, what do you think are the best ideas you've heard about how to guide it in a way that's fair, that's going to have good outcomes and not bad, that you know, that people have access to in equitable ways? I mean, have you encountered anybody who has done the best, what you would consider the best thinking so far on the ethics of gene alteration?
You know, I in the United States, the government is really just being very emphatic in not wanting to really talk about these issues at all. So, you know, not only is it not allowed to do germline modification, but you can't do any research that might lead to that. And so we're not really having a meaningful conversation in the United States yet, I think. Unfortunately, what that means is that people are going to want to go to other countries where there is no particular regulation one way or the other, and do that in sort of, you know, in clinics sort of on that are hidden from view. And in my book, I talk about one case where actually this has already happened. A couple went to Mexico, and an American doctor joined them there to basically replace the mitochondria in this woman's eggs with healthy ones. So, you know, there are some genetically modified people alive today. There are a few, but they're already here. I think that it's a better way to deal with this is what England is doing. So in England, this treatment called mitochondrial replacement therapy, there was a lot of research that was done on it, using animals, using you know, eggs, human eggs, and so on. And then Parliament actually had a big full debate about it, and, you know, the advantages and the possible risks and the ethics and so on. And then they decided, well, we're going to allow this to happen, but it's going to happen under these rules. So, you know, you can't just like walk into any doctor's office and get this therapy. Like, that, you know, we're going to take real care to make sure that this is done safely and responsibly and under the right circumstances. And so now there is a university that has actually, you know, gotten permission to basically open their doors for business. And I think that's the way to go. Because then you can have these discussions and say, like, you know what, as a society, we don't want people to be trying to make their kids more intelligent by altering their genes. We think that's bad for individuals and bad for society. We're not going to allow it. And that will actually happen rather than sending people to other countries to have, you know, possibly dangerous treatments. That's the way I think things should go. And you can see an example of it in England, and it would be great if the United States could follow suit.
You know, on this show a lot we talk about how often, like, science fiction is sort of the playground for people working out these problems before they're dealt with in the real world. Have you encountered any science fiction or fiction in general that you thought did a good job of dealing with raised the interesting questions, had intelligent things to say about the implications of genetic engineering in humans?
Oh, yeah. I think that there's a long tradition of genetic engineering in science fiction. And even before people really knew what genetic engineering was, you know, Brave New World is a fascinating book, even now. I mean, and it's amazing when you think how much was only discovered after the publication of the book. And I find that one quite prophetic. I think the problem with science fiction comes when people think that anything can happen, that when people think that biology allows anything you can imagine to be a possibility. And the fact is that biology doesn't work that way. And so, you know, when we're actually talking, you know, today about, well, what are the real possibilities that CRISPR could create? I think we need to make sure that we're not just letting our fantasies run wild. You know, some people have said like, oh, well, you'll just be able to CRISPR your kid and turn them into a genius. And that is not what science indicates. I mean, intelligence is this incredibly complex phenomenon that is, you know, influenced by genes. It's influenced by the environment. It's partly a social thing, you know, in terms of like, you know, intelligence really sort of gaining its meaning in, you know, in a society. You can't just zoom in on a few genes and make a tweak here and there and say, aha, like now my child is going to, you know, get into the very best colleges. It does not work that way. And I think that if people just go ahead with it anyway, those children are going to be born not just with these odd little changes to their genes, but with a whole huge set of expectations from their parents. You know, I spent $100,000 to change your genes to make you a genius. And why are you getting these grades in math? What's wrong with you? I just see the real dystopia emerging is just expecting heredity to do much more than it can possibly do to alter ourselves.
That's really interesting, and it raises another question that definitely comes up in the book, which is that even when we're talking about traits that are to some large extent heritable, what are some of the reasons that it can create misunderstandings for us to talk about there being, quote, a gene for a certain trait?
Yeah, we really have come to look at genes as being all-powerful, and that is a real mistake. But it's hard to really get your head around the paradox of heredity in this regard. And one of the examples I like to talk about is height. You know, height seems like it's simple. Like it's just a number that you get off a tape measure. Like how hard could that be to understand? But, you know, in fact, heredity is this very weird mix of genes and the environment. So height is very, what scientists say, very heritable, meaning that if you look at the variation among people in a particular population, why are they tall, why are they short, you can explain a lot of that because of the genes that they inherited from their parents. So tall parents tend to have tall children, short parents tend to have short children. So that means it's very heritable. But that does not mean that, you know, height is somehow locked in and fixed. It does not mean that you can actually, you know, finally predict how tall a kid will be just based on their genes. In fact, we didn't even know about any of these genes until the past decade or so. And now scientists are discovering literally thousands of genes that influence height, each one in a tiny little bit. You know, I got my genome sequence and discovered, you know, that I was very interested to find that I had one particular gene. It was the first gene that was ever linked to height in populations. And I'm about an eighth of an inch taller than I would be otherwise because of the variant that I have. So, you know, it's almost invisible. But you know, the genetic influence just is the sum of all of these different variants. And yet, on top of all of that, you know, you can have, you know, all the tall genes you want, but if you're not getting a good diet when you're a kid, and if you're facing dysentery on a regular basis, you're just not going to grow that tall, because your body is going to be basically channeling all those resources to fighting disease and to, you know, fight off, defend against starvation. And, you know, on top of that, even more amazing to me is that, you know, the whole world has actually gotten several inches taller over the past century, because life overall is better. You know, there's more people have better nutrition, better medicine, education probably plays a role in this. And so it's not that people inherited, you know, quote unquote, tall genes. It's that they inherited a world that favors greater height.
So I've got one last question that might be kind of weird, but we'll see what you think of it. I often hear people talking about their relationship with their own genome, with their own genes in two basic ways. One is self-identification. You know, it's like my genes are why I am like X, and so there's a sort of I identify with my genes mentality. And then there's a kind of antagonistic kind of thing people think about with their genes, like the genes are this other disembodied force that made them, and it's almost like another person that they have to negotiate with in some way. To what extent do you, given all of the research you've done and after having written this book, to what extent do you feel you are your genes, or that your genes are this separate other force from you as a person?
That's interesting. I've heard that kind of language too, you know, and people will get their DNA sequenced and they'll discover they have a particular variant linked to some trait, and they'll say, well, that's why I do XYZ. Or they'll discover they have ancestry from a particular place and say, well, that's why I like to tell stories, or that's why I like to run, or what have you. And you know, you see ads on TV for these companies like Ancestry.com that play on that exact attitude towards our genes, that somehow, you know, what we do in our lives is encapsulated in these genes that we inherit from our ancestors. And then there are people who just want to fight against it. You know, and part of that sometimes feels like, you know, it's sort of a displaced fight they're having with their parents, you know, like, I'm not going to be like you were, you know, and I don't care if I inherited genes from you, I'm going to be my own person. I would say in my own experience, you know, I got my genome sequenced and part of the research for this book, and I've really looked at it very deeply. It's been a fascinating experience, but I can't find anything in there that is quote unquote me. I think that it's just not there. You know, I was able to look at the genes that I inherited from Neanderthals, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, and you know, which is fascinating. But then I say to these scientists, like, okay, you've given me this catalog of Neanderthal genes. Let's talk about them. Like, what does it mean that I inherit this particular, like, here's one gene. Tell me about it. And the scientists would be like, well, it looks like no one actually knows what this gene does at all. You know, and then you're just sort of left there with the state of the science. You know, I found that I have a Neanderthal gene that is linked to an increased risk of nosebleeds.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with that, you know, it also makes me wonder why Neanderthals might have nosebleeds, but that's a whole separate issue. But, you know, I can't say that anything I've done looking at my own DNA has given me some deep insight about my inner self as a person, you know, as it's much more relevant to me to think about, you know, how my parents raised me and what my experiences were as a kid and what it has been like, you know, being married and being a father. Like, the lived experience matters much more to me than the details of the genome I inherited from my parents. And that's kind of where it stands for me now.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Carl. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today, and we appreciate you taking time to speak with us.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
So there you have it. Thanks once again to Carl Zimmer for coming on the show and having this just wonderful chat with us about his new book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. Again, that's available in hardback, as a digital, and as an audio book right now. And you can check out Carl's website, carlzimmer.com, for even more about him and his projects.
That's right. Go to that website.
And hey, be sure to check out our website as well. It's stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all of our episodes. You'll also find links out to our various social media accounts, so you can check those out as well. I want to remind everybody, if you want to support the show, one of the best things you can do is rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Big thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you want to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for a future episode, or just to say hi, let us know where you listen to the show from, what you think about it, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Thank you.